Expo Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine others, still reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Big sticks go boom, and the monkeys jump into the room. The squirrels of doom are running all over the place. And then I just completely forgot another word that rhymes with boom. Hello, everybody in the After Out Land. Welcome to our amazing episode 235. Tonight on the show, we have Andrew Robertson, who is the editor and good guy who runs the Great Lakes Horror Company. How's it going, Andrew?
It is going very well. In fact, it's horrific. Thanks, Bill.
Hey, you're wonderful. Horrific is always good. And I don't know what just happened there. Somebody just said something in the chat room. I'll leave that to EW to play with.
What just happened there?
I don't know. Shit happens in the chat room all the time. Sometimes it makes sense and sometimes it doesn't. So, tell us a little bit about this wonderful little thing, book, anthology called Hexed.
So, Group Hex Volume 1, the way that that was born was about a year ago. I joined the Horror Writers Association. I was an unpublished horror writer, but a published writer. And I was, you know, looking at what we were doing at conventions and how we promoted the chapter. And, you know, some people were in between books. They were waiting to have a new book published. And I thought, you know, what would be really good is if we had an anthology that was kind of like a sampler. Where anyone within the Ontario chapter of the Horror Writers Association that wanted to participate could submit, and we would take reprints and originals and create one volume that basically was like a calling card for everybody in the organization, and it would be something that was always there, that we could sell at conventions, that we could give to reviewers, and that people in the organization that we either, like myself, unpublished in the genre, or published and just looking to have something fresh and new to offer their fans, something that they would have there. So we did a call for submissions. We used the Great Lakes Horror Company, which is our podcast that I think we'll talk about later, as the publishing company for it. And sent a call out to all the members. We had 19 members in the end that participated. Some great names, some bestsellers, some cult favorites, and some complete newcomers. And so now we have this great volume, and we're looking at doing a couple more. We've got new members coming on all the time. So it's just a great sort of sampler of all the different types of writing and subject matter that you cover in the horror genre.
Excellent. And do I know any of these people in this book?
Well, you know me.
I do.
You know what? I should actually grab a copy off the shelf. Hold on a second.
You know what? I still have to get a copy from you.
Well, I'm going to see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
At a lunch party that we're going to talk about in a second.
What exactly. Wrong? Now, I just looked at the list of everybody in the book, and I think I have spoken to everybody in there.
I think that you know everyone here as well, yeah.
Yep.
So we've got Kelly Armstrong, who a lot of people may know as occupying three shelves at Indigo, along with Stephen King. She's a New York Times bestseller and Globe and Mail bestseller, I believe also Daily Mail UK. Very prolific writer. So she's actually a member of the Horror Writers Association, which is how we got her to be a part of the anthology.
Yay.
We also have Nancy Kilpatrick, who many people know as the Vampire Queen, and deservedly so. She just has story after story of sexy, vicious, gorgeous vampires. So she's got a story in here called The Shaft. We have Sephora Girone, who is also a prolific writer that's been a longtime horror writer and member of the Horror Writers Association, and she's also the president of the Ontario chapter. So she has a work in here. Who else do we have? Monica Kubler, who's the editor of Rue Morgue magazine. And she has an excerpt from her novel Bleeder, which will be coming out in print very soon. That has been serialized on Wattpad and has been an incredibly popular serial for her. So she's sort of been auto-publishing and workshopping it with fans directly over a number of years, from what I understand. And so I think it's very exciting for a lot of her fans to be looking forward to a print version. So this is a bit of a print preview. And then a lot of other great writers, including Zombie Zack.
Holy crap! I know that guy.
Yeah.
I actually do know that guy. Wait.
Yeah.
Oh, that's me. Ha ha.
And there's actually an illustration right beside his piece in the book that we thought spoke very well to the zombie.
See? Gosh darn it, now I haven't even seen the book yet.
It's, I would say it's a cross between Freddy Krueger and a Scarecrow. It's
excellent.
By Toronto artist Lisdom, who's in a lot of collections around the world. In fact, we were very lucky. I decided to make this an illustrated anthology because I love the idea of having little breaks in the book where you may want to rest from reading, but you want to look at something. So we've got some great artists. We've got Monster Matt Patterson, who is a horror comedian, award-winning, and he's out of Buffalo, but he's a member of the Ontario chapter because of the geography. We've got Izzy McCoy, who's been published in The Walrus and numerous other amazing publications, who participated in this. Brett Baker and TMI, The Monster Inside, who have both worked with Rumorg and Fangoria. And then we've got TDZ, who is an artist in Toronto that shows regularly. And she's at an intersection between goth horror and pop culture.
Ooh, so scary but fun.
Yeah, scary but great to look at.
There you go. Well, yeah. So who did the cover? Because I love the cover. And I know that we had discussions about that before, where it's like, you wanted to go with green, but everybody kept telling you green on the flames. It was like, oh, don't do that. But
am
it's
I
like,
allowed to swear on this show?
Huh?
Am I allowed to swear on this show?
You can swear on this show. It is absolutely appropriate. If I find it offensive, I bleep it out later. I don't normally find it very offensive because I can probably swear outswear you.
Oh, the disgusting. Let me get my tongue back into my face.
Twist it back into shape, man. Twist it.
I'm just going to put a splint on it. The fucking colors on the cover. That was a whole discussion because I told everyone that for this series, I wanted the covers to be mainly black, but the only colors would be highlighter shades. So the first one would be neon green, the second one would be pink, the third one would be orange. And I had a logic behind that because after doing conventions with the association for a year and looking at the front and back covers and the spines of hundreds and hundreds of books, you want to stick out a little bit. And there's just too many covers that look like they were done with Crayola and then just a big black wash on top of it. Just like a lot of sort of scribbling, over-filtered. I don't know if it's a result of having access to too many filters and people getting their covers done for free, but I was not having that. I wanted something stylized and cool to look at. So my partner's a graphic designer that actually works for a major textile designer in North America and has worked in many other industries in graphics. But it's also a huge fan of Transformers and Samurai Jack.
Samurai Jack is awesome.
Well, that's, I think anyone that looks at the cover and thinks of Samurai Jack will understand exactly where his motivation came from. So he did it very much in that style where you have color blocks, but with no outlines, and the gradations of color create the borders, between different elements. And for people who haven't seen it, it's a giant green bonfire with five different monster arms coming out. And we've got a werewolf, a witch, a vampire, a zombie, and a skeleton. And that was to represent the diversity within the book itself. You know, we have monster stories, we have psychological stories, we have atmospheric environmental horror, and then we have, straight up just monsters. So it represents the diversity within. But I'm really happy with it. I think it's a very bold cover. Not everyone agreed with me. And what Zach was referring to before was two different people shit on me because they said that green is a sci-fi color, not a horror color.
Well, it's also a fantasy color as well, because whenever you hear the expression eldritch fire, it's green.
Oh, of course. And so, let's get some scary eldritch fire up on this book. And
well, as Jack just said in the chat room, he likes green and fuck anybody who don't. So,
yeah, exactly.
Now, I like the cover because it is striking. It's a nice strong black with strong white, and then you have a little bit of color. It's like, that actually highlights quite well. Because I put it up on my Facebook as my profile picture right now, and it'll stay up there like for a week or so. So anybody awesome. Who wants to see it, that's what it looks like. Or they can go buy it online where?
Amazon.ca, Amazon.com, any of the Amazon sites internationally, and you can get it on Kindle. And that's just the first 3 months. After that, we'll be offering on other platforms.
Ooh, like what other kinds of platforms?
It'll be available as a Kobo, any kind of Mobi or PDF file, and we'll have it up on a couple of other bookseller sites. It's also available in Toronto at Glad Day Bookshop on Church Street, and we're working on a couple of other retail outlets to get it on shelves so people can just walk in somewhere and pick it up so they don't have to wait.
Okay, well, that kind of leads into something else, but we will come back to Group Hex Volume 1 because I have some specific things I want to talk to about that. But Glad Day Bookstore is what for us right now?
Glad Day Bookshop is on Church Street, just south of Church and Wellesley. It is North America's oldest LGBT bookshop, so it's got that historical distinction, but they also have the distinction of being the lovely people that are going to host our lunch party in Toronto tomorrow. That kicks off at 7 p.m., so we'll be doing a bit of networking. We've got some media dropping by, and we'll be selling some raffle tickets for our charity Warm It Up that helps buy food cards for homeless and underemployed people in Toronto. We've got some great prizes for that, including an autographed print from Joe D'Alessandro, who starred in Andy Warhol's Dracula and Frankenstein. And he was one of the original Andy Warhol superstars, also one of the last left alive. And he is an awesome guy, so he sent that over. We have a signed copy of Kelly Armstrong's Omens. Sorry, I was reading something in the chat room that made me laugh. Yeah, exactly. Who owns green? No one owns green. No genre owns green. That won't make sense to anyone listening to this after the fact. But anyways, that's a discussion in the chat room. I should keep my eyes averted from that while I'm trying to answer a question. So we have the Kelly Armstrong book signed. We have a couple of copies of Brad Middleton's Undead TV, which is a history of vampires on television. And we have a couple of awesome sleep masks, courtesy of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. So we'll be raffling those off, and then the performances and the readings kick off at 7:30. Allison Chains, Toronto drag queen with a super hairy cleavage, is going to be hosting that for us. She'll keep it moving. She'll be breaking up the readings with some performances. And we've got some great people reading. We've got Stephanie Bedwell-Grime, Crystal Burke, who's a newcomer to the genre. We've got Brian Clement, who is about to launch the sequel to his first book, The Final Transmission. Who else do we have? Monica Kubler, Sephora will be reading, Lou Rera, Stephen B. Pearl. So we've got a really full schedule. It's going to be an action-packed hour. 7:30 to 8:30 will be the official programming. And as I said, from 7 o'clock on, it's a bit of networking and schmoozing. We also have catering from the wonderful girls at Cardinal Rule, which is at 5 Roncesvalles in Toronto, but they are also partnering with the Glad Day Bookshop, and they're the official catering and snack providers on site.
So, wait, there's food?
There is food. There's going to be hot mackie and sliders that Marta Kusel is the originator of. It's like she does these sushi rolls, but they're made out of like pasta and macaroni with meat in them. So okay. Everyone, think about that for a second. Any of you carb heads that...
I'm a carb head, but I'd have to think about what kind of meat.
I don't know.
Because if it's fish, I ain't touching it.
Oh, no, I don't think she'd mix macaroni and fish.
Okay, good. Because I don't know. Some stuff out there is weird, and I'm weird. Sometimes it doesn't work, but I'm okay.
Well, I'll pass it on. I'll make sure.
Whatever.
I was at Glad Day earlier and I let them know about this, so they may be listening, and if they are, just don't put any fish in the damn mackie.
No fish! I throw up in 4 hours later.
Well, you'll be gone by then. We don't need to worry about that.
Oh, okay. I need to worry about that because I don't want to clean up the mess.
Yeah, it might be in your car with that timing.
Ugh, that's disgusting, McKayton. So, that's all cool and groovy. So, I just wanted to know, talk a little bit about... So I know you had fun putting this book together as your first anthology, trying to design it. What are some of the like hurdles that people should try and avoid doing? Because I'm quite sure you had a few to play around with.
Oh, yeah, it was like one of those things where you're talking to your friends when you've been out drinking one night, and you're like, you know, let's all go skiing tomorrow morning, and it'll be amazing, and we'll drive to Blue Moonstone and blah. And the next morning, one person gets up, everyone else is smart enough to be asleep, and that one person is like, come on, let's still do it. That was me. So I thought, well, we're going to do this. And it's always been my mandate in life that if you want to do something, if you think about doing something, you might as well do it. Because what are you waiting for? A year from now, you know, you're still going to write that bestseller or go to the gym every day or whatever. You know, like just get off the pot and do what it is that you want to do. And so I took the project on. The first thing I learned is never set a deadline for when, set a deadline for people to give you things, but don't tell them a date that it's going to be out, because they've got nothing to do but ask you why it's not out yet, why it's not done yet.
Is it out yet? Is it out yet?
Oh, yeah.
Is it out yet?
Why haven't I seen a proof yet? That's weird, because I sent you something 2 months ago, and I think to myself, are you kidding me? I sent something to a publisher 6 months ago. I'm not emailing them every day asking. It's just because they know me. They think they can. Well, that's when Mean Andrew comes out. But it was a hell of a process. A lot of people said, well, you know, you just get everything. You format it. They have a template, and you drop it in. And the system says it's either good or it tells you what's wrong with it and you fix it. But it's not like that at all. It really isn't. It's like the template is doomed to fail. You have to have done it a couple of times or have legendary patience. And anyone that knows me knows that I like to get things done and I like them done properly. But I'm not going to sit there for 2 weeks and figure out how to format something the way that CreateSpace wants it to, because, I don't know, I feel like it's designed to steer you in a certain direction. So I procured some assistance to do it.
Uh-oh.
And even then, with the back and forth for the approvals process, getting it back to the authors for them to proof their own work, to let me know what changes were made, and then to send it back to the publisher. You have to do it line by line. You know, we're talking page 9, second paragraph, third line, reads like this, should read like this. And so just picture doing that a couple of hundred times, and then, you know, getting the proof back, and the illustrations are in the middle of the text. You know, they're under a header here and there. Some of the author's names are on the wrong pages with the wrong chapters. I was just pulling my hair out, you know, there was like not enough wine in the world to make it seem okay, but
you got my poem in there in okay, right?
Yeah, yours looks fine.
Okay, good. Mine should be easy because it's in a structure that formats like that.
Well, you know, everyone else's, anything that was wrong, I just went through all the books when I got them and I took a black crayon and I just marked it out. So there's, you know, all the mistakes are gone, and it looks fine. So I guess it's okay.
Oh, okay.
You know, for some of them, I just put a big sticker on the mistakes, or, you know, highlighted parts that I think people should read.
Right.
And yes, publishing is hard, and you should leave it to other people, Jack William Finley. You're totally right.
It is. And I'm personally planning on self-publishing a few books this year. So this is why I'm always fascinated by the experiences that people go through in setting up that process, because it's always anecdotally amusing. Okay, so maybe I should make sure to do some of this stuff before I do that stuff. Learning type curve stuff.
It's like that Kate Bush song, Running Up That Hill.
Oh, I love that song.
You never make a deal with God. It, like, you never meet him. You're just fucking running forever. And eventually you give someone $200 to fix it.
Ah, you did that, huh?
I'm a firm believer that you should learn to do as much as you can on your own. But everyone has an area of expertise, and everyone has patience and understanding and skills in different areas. And at some point, you have to realize, much like myself in math, some of us can't do it, but there are people who can do math.
Math is good.
Yeah.
And, that's how I get paid.
Yeah.
I like math.
Often.
Well, as much as I can get, I tend to try to do the math, because it's like, oh, yeah, you owe me $5 more. No, that's five. No, that's 10 there.
You know, it's good to know how to calculate interest on anything that benefits you.
Yes, indeed.
But they have internet for that. There's percentage calculators all over the place. There's just nowhere that you can drop a bunch of stories into that spits them out and it looks good. But anyways, it was done. It's complete. And for the second one, a lovely maiden named Julianne Snow has agreed to... she's from Siren's Call Publications. Everyone should check that out. They have regular calls for submissions. They have a great free e-zine that goes out to thousands of people monthly or bi-monthly. Because it is a, you know, it's a type of organization where it's not a totally regular schedule, but it's pretty regular. And she's going to be helping me put together Group Hacks Volume 2, which I'm doing despite all of the madness that that this one created.
Yes.
There were nights at 1 a.m. where I was looking at going, no, I can do this. I can figure this out. Why won't the page break work? Well, yeah, the page broke, and that was it.
You know I'm giggling over here, right?
It's fucking page breaks. Page breaks.
Page breaks never break. They break you.
It's true. Exactly.
I know.
What happened.
I know. I've heard it many times from many people. That's why I'm watching and learning from others before I start doing my own.
Well, Zombie Zach, I would highly recommend just getting Julianne beside you for the first one and having her walk through it, because that's definitely what I'm going to do with with the second one. I mean, it is possible. There are people out there that are very good with formatting, but I think I'm more of an organizer than an executor when it comes to publishing.
Cool. Well, like you said, everybody has their strengths and everybody has their areas where they need to work on or need to find a different solution to.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, that is the way the game plays. So I wanted to jump now over into Great Lakes Horror Company for a second. Well, probably for more than a minute, anyways. What is the Great Lakes Horror Company?
So the Great Lakes Horror Company is the podcast, the official podcast featuring members of the Horror Writers Association Ontario chapter. When I joined in November of 2015, being unpublished, you know, I'm sitting there at meetings. I don't really have much necessarily to share, but I did have a lot of questions and a lot of ideas that I wanted to talk to people about. So instead of just asking people and learning for myself, I thought, why don't we start a podcast featuring members of the chapter where we do roundtables on given topics and interviews with well-known authors and up-and-comers and also people sort of on the fringe of the writing industry and broadcast it on iTunes. So all the questions that I asked on given themes, people could listen to and learn from people that had been in the industry for 10 to 20 years, that had lots of experience with the ups and downs. I mean, you go to any sort of writer's panel and people want to know, how do I get published? How do I get people to pay attention to me? You know, how do I get my name and my writing out there? What should I do with my submissions? And so we couched all of that in the podcast and still do in the horror genre. And there's a lot of horrific things about publishing on its own. So it sits there really, really comfortably. But it's been really interesting. You know, I think some of our upcoming episodes, we're going to have roundtables on plagiarism, on rejection letters, but we've also done, you know, how to not have a shitty horror cover. there's a lot of books. I mean, we were just talking about covers earlier. There's a lot of books out there that that could be phenomenal, but I'm one of those people that judges a book by its cover. I don't care if you tell me not to. If I look at it and it just looks like a worn out banana peel, I'm not really interested. You know, there's so many features to publishing that you need to pay attention to.
Or if it looks like a 5-year-old designed it.
Yeah, exactly. Like what I was talking about with all the filters and the Crayola and the scribbling all over everything. And like, we don't need another book where half someone's face is torn off or whatever. Like, it's just, there's things that are done and overdone. And, you know, so those are the kind of topics that we go into. Some people think it's not important and their words will speak for themselves, but we're a visual culture. That's why Instagram is so popular. People constantly go onto their phones, but they prefer visual storytelling now. So your cover is telling the story of your book that will get people, especially millennials who are used to getting visual cues for everything, to get them to read 200 pages after that, you know? And I think even, you know, I'm not pointing the finger at millennials, but even those of us, you know, around, let's say, the 40 mark.
Well, millennials, bilennials, selennials, any of the other ellennials, all of them.
Octennials.
Yes.
Tentacles.
Hey, don't go into tentacle land. That's just creepy weird. But I wanted to put that visual thing into a context. Look at Facebook. How many likes and shares do you get from a picture with text? How many likes and shares do you get a just text?
Exactly.
Yep.
If you include an image or a video clip, you have 80% more likelihood of engagements, views, click-throughs.
Guess what that was? That was math.
That, yeah.
See?
There's a lot of math behind that.
Math is good for you.
Oh, are you telling me that I was doing math and I didn't even know it?
Exactly.
Now, I just repeat what people tell me at the office. I work in communications.
So okay.
We have a great social media guru in the office that gives me all the statistics. And yeah, if you want someone to pay attention to something that you put online, put a picture up and try and make it original. And, you know, do the same with your writing. If you're going to post, you know, a note on Facebook or you have a WordPress blog and you want to put your story up, find a good image or better yet, create one yourself or with a friend who's an artist. And that'll guide people. If you look at creepypastas, you know, which are incredibly popular, whether they should be or not, and looked at them, they always have the most friggin' gruesome picture that gives you an idea of what the story is. And it's always something kind of like mysterious, like whether it's like the Russian sleep experiment or Slender Man. I mean, they're images that obsess us, and then we want to read the words that accompany it. And that's the type of culture that we are. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I guess we could abide by that. I was going to say, yeah, use your crayons. Crayon pictures always sell.
But back to the podcast. That was one of the topics.
Exactly. So how long has the podcast been running? How many episodes are out now?
It started in February of last year, and I think that we're sitting at around 21 episodes.
Cool.
We had started off trying to do weekly, which was really ambitious. And it worked for a bit, but you know, life tends to get in the way because a lot of us have other things that we need to do, including writing.
No.
Yeah. And put, as you know, putting together a weekly or biweekly or even a monthly podcast or radio show involves a lot of background work that people don't necessarily think about. So we're right now, in summer we went down to biweekly, and right now we've decided that we're going to do monthly shows for a while. Which I think is fine. You know, once a month you get to hear from us, and we'll still be bringing great interviews. I mean, we've had some fantastic people on the show. And that's going to continue. We've got some new people participating, so we may go back up to biweekly in a couple of months. But it's been really well received. We've been on New and Noteworthy on iTunes for quite some time against some really popular shows. And so I think the work that it took to get the podcast together and out there, it's definitely worth it. It's just a matter of keeping that momentum going, but also being true to yourself and understanding what you and the team around you can actually accomplish and still keep that quality up there. So for now, we're going to do monthly.
Cool. Now, as I recall in the original discussion, because I think I'm one of the guys in that podcast sometimes.
Yeah, I feel like we've met.
I think we have. I know that one of the concepts behind it was to help promote not only writing in general, literature in general, specifically horror, but the individuals that are associated to it as sort of a means to, well, do you know what people like to get? They like to get free stuff, even if it's just information about stuff. And the podcast in and of itself is a informational type thing, anecdotally. And on top of that, you're also hearing about real people who are real authors doing real things.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone involved in the podcast, the way that we structure the questions, they're pulling on their real life experiences. You know, so it may be, you know, you get to a horror convention, you want to do a pitch with editors. What's the best way to do that without coming out feeling like an asshole? You know, because some people think, hey, I can just walk into a horror convention, sit down with my manuscript, hand it to the editor and tell them, you know, it's just like The Exorcist with werewolves. And they're just going to look at you cross-eyed and ask if you made an appointment or, you know, if you filled out the paperwork or if you read the guidelines for that. Because every convention has a different sort of a pitch session, and that's something that I learned. You know, you may be walking into it expected to bring, you know, your five best chapters and an elevator pitch, or they may want the entire manuscript, or they may just want you to do an elevator pitch for them, and they'll ask you for you know, the words and the USB stick later. So that's something, you know, like Safra Jerome, that attends a lot of conventions and has for years, is a wealth of knowledge. You know, you're going to World Horror Convention, you're going to StokerCon, you're going to Horrorama. Any of these venues have different types of etiquette in terms of how you're approaching people. Even if you're approaching an artist at one of these venues because you're interested in working with them for your cover or your interior, there's an etiquette involved. And so what we're trying to do is draw on those real life experiences of all these authors, from newbies that are just learning as they go to seasoned vets, and get the word out to the younger generation of dark fantasy and horror writers. And spec fiction. Don't worry, spec fiction. We know you're there. It's all the genre, but I feel the need to say that specifically because some people just do speculative fiction.
Now, for some people who may not know what speculative fiction is, what is that?
How dare you ask me to define that live?
not like, it is like 42% of this and 15% of that. And six. What is it in a general term? Because there's a difference between what they call literary fiction, and then you got your genre fiction and everything else like this. And everybody has their own fuzzy ideals about all this stuff. Speculative is what? Just like way out there?
Well, Billiam, the way that I would describe it is people are familiar with horror as a genre, but when you look more into the early days of horror, where you're dealing with something like, say, The Last Man by Mary Shelley. So, you know, that's a story where this is the last guy on Earth. It seems like it could be maybe more in the literature camp or the science fiction camp because of where it's based, but there is the pain and the horror of the human condition embedded in that story. And when you look at a lot of the more classic work, or maybe even Shirley Jackson, who writes a book like The Haunting of Hill House, and it's not gory in the way that, you know, there's monsters and people getting their arms cut off and there's werewolves and vampires. It's the idea of something that disquiets us as humans and a part of our condition. It often deals with the psychology or the fantastical, but it verges, it's always more on the precipice of darkness. And so speculative fiction covers all of that. In fact, I was talking to someone recently, and they said that a lot of the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's books fall in that category. You look at something like Hound of the Baskervilles,
mm-hmm.
And that's speculative fiction. You look at The Shining, and that's speculative fiction, because they both encompass that human psychology, human condition, the horror of what could and can happen, and every now and then it moves into the fantastical. So it doesn't have to be, you know, ghosts and zombies.
And including everything by Hitchcock that he's ever put on the telly.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think often when people shit on horror as a genre, as sort of like a cheap throwaway pulpy thing, they're forgetting that the horror tradition has brought some of the finest literary works of our century and previous centuries. And just because those books have gotten the literary nod from someone down the line, it doesn't mean it's not a horror novel. We've just given it a different name.
Exactly. Well, horror novel, horror story, or poetry. Because we're looking at Lovecraft, Edgar Allan Poe, a half dozen other guys' names who I can't remember right now, but all of that stuff starts out in the same genre, right, like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, Lovecraft really, you know...
He was nuts, man!
Oh, totally, but, you know, would he be more science fiction because we're dealing with sort of, like, cosmic theology? It could be argued that, but people drop him into horror because, yeah, gross, horrible things happen.
Some indescribable creature without a face that we can't see, and it's, like, so horrible, I can't even describe it. It scared me. I ran away.
I don't know. Sometimes with Lovecraft, it's like, a blobulous creature that you would go insane if you knew what he looked like. And I'm like, you were just drunk that day and lazy, and you didn't want to tell us what he looked like.
Pretty much. But yes, he has that method that he just says, I'm not going to really describe it to you. I'm going to let you describe it. But I'll describe how I felt about it afterwards.
Do you think he invented the Choose Your Own Adventure? And do you think that we're going to get hate mail for saying that?
No, we won't get hate mail for saying that. Yes. I think we'll get hate mail for saying other things a lot worse than that.
All right, let's do it.
Nah, later. But...
I love him. I've got a hardcover by him on the bookshelf. Let's be realistic. I mean, he really left a lot to your imagination.
Dude, he basically said, "I'm scared. I'm running away." Okay.
It looked like an ostrich, and it sounded like a snake. And you're like, "Okay, I'll make up the rest on my own."
Yeah, like Dagon, the story that I gave you there for the audio reading type thing. It's just I'd forgotten how difficult this was to read this story.
Yeah.
Which you did, I don't know, did you notice how often, did it sound smooth to you?
Everything you do sounds smooth to me.
Okay, that's cool, because I edit like a muffin fluffer.
Because you had to say, like, Agathoth, Harafa, Gabanon, like, a million times?
Something like that. Yeah, because that stuff, he uses words that is like, your mouth is not supposed to pronounce those things.
Nah, like a lot of THBs and like very few vowels, or they're in the wrong place. Yeah, good for him.
Like with Army of Darkness, necktie. Sounds right. It was definitely an N-word.
Oh, now, Jeff Ellen says editing is one of my favorite parts of the creative process. I totally agree. That's a really interesting part of the writing process, because you go back and I think sometimes when you're... when you're writing and you're really in the mode, you go back a couple of pages, you know, that day or a couple of days later, and you can be surprised. You look at it, you know, the first two pages, and you think, who the hell wrote that?
Well, that's generally how I read all my writing, because it's like, wait a sec, I wrote that? Let me check that again. Oh, yeah, I did write that.
You surprise yourself, and you're like, shit, that's all right.
Yeah, the best is when, like, I'm falling asleep, and I just keep writing. It's like, I gotta go sleep now. Save. Wake up. What did I write? Oh, okay. Interesting. So, you were speaking about people poo-poo on horror, and I was pretty much in the same vein. I've been playing with this now for about 10 years, I guess, now. And I've always heard the same reaction. Oh, yeah, horror is a genre. It's like, oh, poo-poo-poo. But you go and flip that, and let's put the math into perspective. It is one of the most lucrative... return on investment working environments that you can possibly find. Put out a movie, cost of a budget $4,000. How do you make? You make 60. Why? Because people buy that stuff.
Yep.
Put out a book, werewolf book, zombie book, mummy book, skeleton book, witch books. Witches are popular last year. Werewolves and mummies are going to be popular again this year. But you throw this stuff out there and people soak it up. And it's like, okay.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, you look at, I don't want to bring up Twilight. But
don't bring up Twilight, because that's kind of banned on this show.
I'm a sparkly vampire.
Oh, God.
There was a period where vampires became insanely popular again. And, I mean, it's still, you know, you've got Vampire Diaries and all those shows on TV. And then there were all books that went with it. And then Walking Dead really, really brought zombies right up to the top of the food chain, but they were already on their way there. You know, something like True Blood, as much as I may question some of the content in the books, and that's a completely different discussion, that brought a whole range of different creepy crawlies out of the woodwork. And for people to rip on horror novels as being like bottom of the food chain, they're totally wrong. You know, because if you go through your guide on Netflix or whatever, you're going to find 25% of the content there is based on supernatural phenomenon, monsters, horrific things, true crime. And that's all part of this genre. And people's morbid curiosity and their own sense of mortality is always going to keep them looking, even with one eye, at things like this, whether they're watching it, reading it, listening to an audiobook. People like the creepy shit, because, you know, part of it is our obsession with how fragile we actually are. And the other part is our obsession with creatures that may live forever or have these phenomenal experiences that we may never have. So hopefully people start to consider the genre in a different light soon.
Yes. Actually, I've been finding more and more people have taken more of a stance on, oh, yeah, that's horror stuff. I'm not really a big fan, but at least there's other people out there who enjoy it, whereas it's less the... Ah, poo, it's horror. It's like, that's for other people. I find, like, at my shop, more and more people, it's like, you never know who's going to be the horror fan and who's going to be the not horror fan. I've had people walk in, it's like, so, you probably like Twilight, right? Nah, man, that shit's for wussies. I want something hardcore. I want some True Blood, or I want there's a comic book out by, I'm going to hate myself for not knowing it, but it's called Bad Blood. It's about a kid who has sickle cell anemia, I think, and is impervious to vampire bites because he gives them cancer.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's a great take and spin on the whole idea. It was like a six. Now I have to look it up. Who was that? Okay. Go faster, Google. Go faster, Google. Go faster, Google.
Well, while you're looking that up, I'll just say I find horror fans to be like when you walk into a marijuana dispensary and you're like, oh, all of these people are into this too. You know, you don't know. You've got the business person, you've got the scrubby kid, you've got the teenager, you've got, you know, the 20-something hipster. Like, there's a full spectrum of people interested. But what I hate is when someone tries to pass off something that's legitimately horror and say, oh, it's a thriller. like as if they're the Chardonnay of the beer tent, you know? Like, fuck that.
I can't equate with the Chardonnay, but I'll let you have that. Bad Blood was done by Jonathan Mayberry. Jonathan Mayberry.
Oh, one of our favorites.
One of our favorites. We've liked him for a while.
He does a lot of good work.
Yes, he does. And he does zombies, so it's like, okay, I'm always going to associate and have good fun for that.
So for comics, because I know that's a big thing for you.
Yes.
What's big in the comic world right now? Because I'm very much like a vintagey comic guy. Like the last time I went to the comic book store, I bought, there's one near me that packages like banged up comics and will do like the full set for you. So like 1 to 50 of the New Mutants I bought for like $20.
Really? Well, if you get New Mutants number 98, put that in a very special place.
Which one is that? Is that the first appearance of Cable?
No, that's the first appearance of Deadpool.
Oh, no, I don't have that one. I'm pretty sure they wouldn't...
In near mint condition, it goes for anywhere from $300 to about $1,000.
Well, kids, if you see that hanging out somewhere in the back shelf of the convenience store in the middle of nowhere, pick it up. That's
exactly. I had several copies of that before it became that popular.
Yeah, I had the first appearance of Cable, and it was worth a lot, and then eBay happened, and the price kind of bottomed out, so I was like, whatever. And now it's back up there. I guess over time, you know, there's less and less copies that are viable that are in really good condition.
Exactly.
I don't know what I did with mine, but, I mean, I think people thought that Cable would be more popular than he was. But, yeah, I'm like a real, like, Uncanny X-Men, the original version. I also bought the Handbook to the Marvel Universe because I like reading the... It's like, I'm such a fucking nerd. It's like, I sit there reading the encyclopedia of the Marvel Universe.
Okay.
But I love reading the backstories.
So, you know the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, there's actually three different series, right?
I know that there's the Book of the Dead version and then the Living Ones, but that's all that I know.
Okay, no, those were special extra editions. There's the Deluxe Universe, there's the Standard Universe, and then there was the Updated Universe that they came out with a little while later. The Books of the Dead are just listing all the characters that actually died and stayed dead.
Yeah, and stayed dead is right.
It stayed dead. Like, one of my favorite characters is in that. His name is Adam Warlock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you've got any idea who that is, he should be a big part of the movie coming out in Infinity War in a few years. But we don't think he is.
Ever made.
Huh?
It's going to be the most expensive movie ever made.
Till the next one after that comes out.
Well, they're saying that Infinity Wars Part 1 and 2 is going to run $800 million.
Nice. And it's supposed to have about 62 different superhero characters featured throughout both movies.
I'm thrilled, but I'll tell you my two favorite superheroes.
Go for it.
I don't know if you're going to barf in your hair or whatever, and I'll have to come over and brush it out.
As long as it's not Squirrel Girl.
No, it's the original Spider-Woman and Dazzler.
Okay, Spider-Woman I can take with because I actually collect Spider-Woman. Dazzler is amusing because I have the collection for Dazzler.
Because she was made to like promote Casablanca Records, and I don't know if like Kiss had something to do with that, but... I think that that's got to do with me being gay.
A little bit possibly, but just so you know, Dazzler was always created to be a humorous comic.
Love her. It's campy as hell. I mean, Spider-Woman had that as well, but Spider-Woman definitely was a more serious effort. And I love how they transitioned her into being like a detective when she lost her powers, and then she got her powers back. But
and then there's another Spider-Woman now who's Spider-Woman.
That always kind of bothers me when they just pass it over to someone else. It's like, you're digging characters up from the dead all the time. And like, how many times is Storm going to be like a teenager again and then get to live life all over? Like, you could have just done that for poor Jessica Drew.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm biased.
Mm-hmm.
I'm biased.
Mm-hmm. And then you could probably also say similar things about Hank Pym as a character. They have beat the shit out of him as a character. Because they have made him Ant-Man, Giant-Man, Goliath, Hawkeye, a few other characters as well. It's like, he can't even make up his mind who he is, and then he goes and does this wife-beating thing, and then Captain America punches the shit out of him, and then he goes on trial, then he disappears, then he comes back as the creator of Ultron, then they try to kill him because they're trying to prevent Ultron from being destroyed, so they go back in time multiple times to try and kill him before he makes Ultron. Okay.
You're an encyclopedia for this kind of stuff, which is great, because, you know, there's only so much time in the day to catch up on reading comics often. But you know what I'll say about Spider-Woman that I think is really relevant to the sort of horror and spec fiction genre is a lot of her adversaries really were pulled out of, like, nursery rhymes, and I want to say Grimm's fairy tales, but she even had adversaries. Didn't she have... like the Grimm brothers or something, and then there was Daddy Longlegs and Screaming Mimi, and it was all very like sort of like bizarro fairy tale characters that they were pitting her against that almost seemed like fringe elements of the Marvel universe. But
well, they would take some of the character bad guys from some of the other lines that didn't do so well and tried to pair them in. The Grimm brothers, I think, was a Spider-Man villain at one point originally. And they just segued them over to Spider-Woman. But they also threw them in a few others. And that's kind of what... See, I have... In the old days, Marvel was awesome. You put out a comic book, it's fun, it's a read, and great, there's a story. DC was a little bit more on the mamby-pamby slash, oh, we're going to give you a morality story as well and whatever. And it always got boring to me. Because, like, oh yes, in the end, people should work together and be friends and help everybody.
No, there's nothing like reading a comic for a moral message because you picked it up at Sunday school, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I have Christian comics. They have the same stupid thing, but they're actually worth some money.
Jesus is, like, ripped and hot.
No, I don't have any of those, but...
I'll lend you one.
it's okay, I have enough Jesus. Zombie Jesus, he's got a good comic.
Yes, that is true.
And another one where Jesus hates zombies.
Yep.
If you get a giggle, that one's worth it. Yeah. But what I'm finding nowadays is more and more, Marvel and DC are pushing away from what I would consider the traditional base for readers, like the people who grew up with comics. Now they're gearing it more to a young audience in the way that Harry Potter is geared to a younger audience. And that audience is staying in that reading level. So the comic books stay in that reading level rather than evolving. And what I find is that there's a whole bunch of other independent comic books, Dark Horse and Image put out, and a bunch of other, one of my favorites is Space Goat Publishing put out a book called Zombie Tramp. It's not very deep, it's just funny. But there's a whole bunch of them that are out there that are pushing that envelope. One out there right now called Monstrous takes into account some other strange Cthulhu-type characters, and it pits... the cutesy little cat-type people with humans, and then this really weird, the Eveningtide Court or something like that. And it's a strange, weird combination of things, but it's, like, completely out there.
You know what I'll say to that point is that increasingly I think that we see parents treating their children like as if they're made of fine crystal, and
yep.
children are getting more delicate as we become a more advanced society. Because I remember we were just left to do our own thing, and your mother would pick up your comic book and go, "What is this shit you're reading? I'm throwing this out." And she would still give you $5 at the end of the week, and you would go buy more of what she thought was shit, and you would read it. And that's, you know, that's part of being a kid, is discovering these new, seemingly adult things. And those themes in comic books when we were kids, they weren't designed for a six-year-old's comprehension. They were designed for someone to enjoy the story. And I think a lot of us sort of learn to read and tell stories and become more familiar with human relations and how people dealt with each other from those comic books.
I'm going to give you a mind-blowing thing. Stan Lee, one of the few things that I actually am very, very big fan of that he did, is that he insisted that every single comic they put out was at a reading comprehension level for a college student.
Yeah, and you'll notice that comics of that era, you've got a lot of $5 words in there.
Yep.
And it should be. You shouldn't dumb everything down like the worst daily newspaper because you think maybe your readers won't get it. Because you're going to lose readers who scan through it in a minute, and like it might as well be a Kathy comic. Like, people don't get it. Or like, why don't you have Ziggy write everything for you? I don't even know if people will get those references. But
well, I got the Kathy reference, and I know who Ziggy was, so.
Oh, Kathy. Just like the saddest, loneliest single dyke of 1978. I don't know what was up with that comic. But no, you shouldn't underestimate your audience. You should write the type of stories that you want to tell. And I think that comic books in the late 70s and early 80s, outside of the really pulpy ones that were pulpy and fun for what they were,
yep.
Those amazing story arcs like The Mutant Massacre in X-Men or even Crisis on Infinite Earths in DC, they were very adult. I mean, the first DC comic that I read had Supergirl dead on the cover and Superman carrying her and crying. Is
nice.
Appropriate for a six-year-old? I don't know, but are we going to underestimate every child and assume that, you know, every child at 8 years old should be reading the same comic? No. You know, people are going to search out what they want and what they need for their entertainment and for their personal growth. So, you know, hopefully people keep up the Stan Lee legacy and not make everything monosyllabic and incredibly boring.
Okay. Tag word there for you. Monosyllabic is one of my five top favorite words.
All right.
Because it's a polysyllabic word to talk about a word that has one syllable.
I know, it's stupid, huh?
It's ironic. It's why I love that word so much.
Be Canadian and say monosyllabic, eh?
Yeah, I don't think too many of them do that. But Jeff just said, hey, he's never heard the expression $5 words.
Well, I've got a couple if you want to buy them.
I'm not going to go there.
I take PayPal.
Okay. I'm sure somebody might take you up on that. I'm not, because I have enough $5 words. I have a friend of mine who says when he goes to my blog, he has to take a dictionary all the time. And I say, why? Because you use words I don't know. It's like, well, good. That helps you expand your mind.
Oh, well, as long as it's not because he's too short to see the screen, then that's good. Yeah.
No, he's kind of tall, so it's good. Oh, crap. I was going to say something. Oh, yeah. So, I don't know. Are you a Stephen King fan?
I do like Stephen King. I do feel like I've permanently damaged my reputation with him because one time on the Great Lakes Horror Company podcast, I said he's not my favorite author and that I don't like everything he's done. But I think that's fair to say because, first of all, what's he going to care?
Okay, because what I was going to throw at you is that Marvel has been publishing for the last few years now what started out as an adaptation of stories around the original Dark Tower series.
Okay.
And now this series actually segues into the books. So now we have about, I don't know, 14 different six-issue miniseries things. And I am not a huge Stephen King fan. I've read some of his. I like some. I don't like some. For me, it's a mix. I mean, not everything appeals to everyone. But the comic book series, I absolutely love that series. I have every single issue.
Do you think it's because of the visual storytelling or the elements that they pulled out? Because you're dealing with a lot less words and descriptions when you're getting into comics. So do you think maybe it's like whoever edited the content, it's just more in tune with your likes?
It's
telling the story.
It's a combination of things. It's a combination of what they've actually decided to talk about. It's like the story from Roland's point of view and him going through these life issue things. That was very interesting. The artwork, beautiful artwork, that always grabs my attention.
Yeah, it's important.
And then the way that they're telling the story, it just feels more natural as opposed to reading some of King's books. It's like, this is a big blob of text.
Yeah, there's a lot of descriptions.
Which I'm okay with, because I read books that are 400 pages long. I enjoy that. But sometimes it's not necessarily the best way to read stuff like that.
Yeah, I think when I first got into Stephen King, the first book that I read cover to cover was Four Past Midnight. I was a bit late to the game. And I've read some of his longer works, but my absolute favorite is Salem's Lot, because I'm a vampire fan, but the way that he dealt with that, it was fantastic. And I remember the first time that I read it, I got to a certain section, and there's going to be people that haven't read it, so I'm not going to say what it is, but I had trouble sleeping that night. And it became my first favorite horror novel for that reason. And I've read it again and had the exact same reaction to it. There is nothing like someone talking about what's just underneath while you're in the bed in the dark, and there's no sounds anywhere except maybe a little tapping in the distance, and you just get to lie there and sweat for a while. That's a good book.
Oh, you mean like The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the section that I'm talking about very much reflects The Telltale Heart, so maybe you know exactly which section I'm talking about. Not everything, but I mean, the guy's got tons of work out. I'm not interested in a lot of his, you know, thoughts on writing or, you know, some of his more tame work. I mean, in our house, we actually have a pop-up book, by Stephen King. My partner is a huge fan of Stephen King, so we have tons of hardcovers here. So I've got access to a lot of it. And we even have a signed version of one of his books. But it's not all of it for me, but there's no disputing that he's an incredible and often really elegant writer.
Yes, and we will do that. And I had to look up one more quick thing. Now, have you heard about the biggest book I've ever heard of?
I don't think so.
It's written by Alan Moore. It's called Jerusalem. It's 1,266 pages long.
That's a very long book.
And I'm trying to remember what the page, the word count was. It was some ridiculous amount, like a million words and something like that. It's like, that's a big-ass book.
One volume, or do you have the option of getting it in, like, sections?
All one book. But, so we're getting close to wrapping up. So, we've got the Great Lakes Horror Company podcast. Check it out. Where do you find it? You find it on iTunes. Where else? There's a Facebook.
iTunes is the Great Lakes Horror Company. You can find it on Facebook as the Great Lakes Horror Company. And then on Twitter, you can find us as @GL Horror Podcast.
And we have the Group Hex Volume 1 coming out.
That's available on all your favorite Amazon sites and on Kindle. And then for horror writers, we actually have a new website. We're just populating it now, so it's not completely... not completely populated. There's still some work to do, but you can contact us through it. And that's horror-writers.ca.
Excellent. And we have a launch party.
That is tomorrow, starting at 7 o'clock at the Glad Day Bookshop, 499 Church Street in Toronto at the corner of Church and Wellesley. You've got amazing prizes, great people reading. You've got a hairy drag queen performing and hosting. There's a full bar, full restaurant, and it's all in a bookshop. I mean, it's an amazing place. It's great.
Okay. And?
So it's also fully accessible.
Wheelchair and everything?
Yeah.
Excellent. And I know EW likes me to promote the We Need Your Help campaign for Operation Upgrade. If you get the opportunity to check out the website, there are much confirmation in there about getting some assistance to help our station grow better, because the American government apparently is actually interested in helping companies like TMV grow better. My buddy War Dog just showed up at the end of the show. So, Andrew, thank you very much for coming on the show. Appreciate it tremendously.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
And everybody out there in After Outline, thanks for joining us. Feel free to find us on the Facebook, the Twitter, and everyone else. Come back here every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Have yourself an amazing After Rotten good time.
Of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their picnic.